Upgrade your laundry routine with a durable and reliable Maytag laundry pair at Lowe's. Like the new Maytag washer and dryer with performance-enhanced stain-fighting power designed to cut through serious dirt and grime. And what's great is this laundry pair is in stock and ready for delivery when you need it the most. Don't miss out. Shop Maytag in-store or online today at Lowe's.
Welcome to the Summer Solstice edition of the Hadean Podcast. This month we welcome Briar, folk witch, cunning woman, sister of the concealed courtage, and author of The Beheading Game, Unearthing the Occult Mysteries of the Celtic Cult of the Head. In this guide to the underworld, Briar leads us on a journey into ancient practices of beheading in Celtic culture, the nature of the Fae, of foreign gods and the Lord of the Harvest, Crom, as well as the mysteries of the Seat of the Soul, the Stars of Orion, and the Harsh Winds of the North. You are really in for an absolute treat with this episode, especially if you are interested in the manner in which traditions of spirit magic have evolved across the European continent. If you enjoy this podcast, please be sure to like, comment and share everything that you can do to help us spread the word of the underworld and help Hadean's global authorship is greatly appreciated. You can now find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Amazon Music, etc., listed as Underworld with Hadean Press, where I am steadily updating our back catalogue. Please support us there if you are able and help spread the word. I am your host, Matt Hadfield, and it is with great pleasure that I introduce Briar to the Hadean Press podcast. Briar, welcome to the podcast.
Heya, thank you for having me. I'm really grateful to be here.
We are here today to talk about The Beheading Game, Unearthing the Occult Mysteries of the Celtic Cult of the Head. But before we start, could you please tell us a little about yourself and what got you interested in the subject of magic and the occult?
Sure. So people generally know me or follow my work for one of three things. It's either my fairy doctoring and my sharings regarding that, or my sharings on witchcraft, spirit work, and folk magic, or plain and simple, my brigading devotion. So I really love doing research, and I write a lot about all of these topics on my website, The Green Chapel. What else can I tell you? I'm an animist. I'm forever trying to find bridges between my native and my adoptive spiritual lineages, because I was born and raised in the French Alps and I moved to the UK in my 20s. As for, you know, what got me interested in magic and the occult, it's really hard now at 30 plus to sort of pinpoint where that comes from. But, you know, as far as I remember, I was a bit of a weird kid. I was always into some weird stuff. Growing up, I was a bit lucky because I had close parents, stepmom who would, you know, teach me about astrology, divination. My grandma was into some shit as well, and other bits of esotericism. So I think, you know, I sort of grew up with things, but I didn't realize all of this existed for real until later on, I would say, my first year of uni, when I discovered the term animist. And from then on, it just all really clicked, because I pretty much immediately fell into witchcraft. But ironically, being a witch, witchcraft is perhaps the least of what it is I practice nowadays, which is interesting. It appears, you know, that the fairy doctor in folklore always ends up killing the witch, and that happens in my own nature as well. As for fairy doctoring, you know, spirits in these traditions are our primary teachers, but I was really lucky because I had a human mentor who taught me much of my craft. They recognized signs that I had been marked by spirits and gods that they knew, And so they elected me to teach me and initiated me into that particular strand of lineage of, Phariseeship that was theirs. And the way they phrased it was that they were welcoming me home, so they really passed on their knowledge as one would do a family member, which was really, really humbling. And at the time, I felt super grateful, but also a bit ashamed because I knew absolutely nothing, So there was a lot of conflicting feelings that have, to be honest, not completely yet passed because I can't forget that, of course, I'm not Irish, I'm French. And I had a lot to learn, a lot to learn. So yeah, my mentor never said that Irishness, as she dubbed it, was a defining factor to the devotion that was ours or to the craft that was ours, but I'm always conscious of what it is I like, of what I'm and what I'm not. So I really don't want, to misrepresent myself or what it is I do. She was aware as well of my mostly agnostic upbringing, because even though, as I said, I had family members who were into some things and sort of believes, but didn't believe, it was a bit, not taking themselves seriously. My mentor felt that respect and piety towards the spirits, a willingness to learn, and the proper marks or permissions from the overworld indicating that I could do so really outperformed, political concerns or geographical concerns or even my self-sabotage tendencies or my far too inclined mind to skeptical inquiry. So they really just explain matter-of-factly, you have the power and you're meant to cultivate it. That's it.
Wow. So you feel that this was something that was, how would I put it, innate within you?
I don't think it's innate within me, no. I think I was marked in my infancy. I personally don't have any memory of it, but my parents could tell you about near-death experiences as I was, a baby. There might be some things linked to inheritance, but to be honest, this is still things I'm passing through, and I'm always very wary about things like that. Even, all those things about marks and signs, even if it's very real in folklore, I think that has a potential to devolve into elitism and stuff like that I'm really not big on. So, yeah.
Oh yeah, I understand that entirely. And especially anyone who's undergone any form of initiationary process will know that there are no hard answers at the end, and you're often left with more questions.
Yes, very much so. I felt like I was craving so much answers, but that I didn't even have the proper questions, because it's one thing, I think, as an adult to seek certain initiations into some lineages, but when you're told by a complete stranger almost, a significant part of your life story, like this happened to you probably had that, and everything was right, everything was spot on. That really freaked me out.
So, talking about your pamphlet today and this idea of headlessness, many of our listeners will, of course, be familiar with the Greek acephalos, the headless one, who has been an almost ever-present aspect of modern culture for about 100 years or so now. But you are not discussing this figure in your work, but instead, you have cast a much wider net in an attempt to explore this spiritual motif of headlessness. So, for our listeners, would you explain a bit about what it was that inspired you to write about this subject?
Yes, you're right. I don't talk, or only in the vaguest terms about the headless one or acephalos, because of course, when you talk about anything headless, you do need to acknowledge that. But on principle, I try not to write or speak about things I don't know much about, and it's safe to say that I'm absolutely clueless with anything ceremonial magic, Greco-Egyptian magic, high magic, or grimoire magic as a whole, save perhaps for my sabbatic explorations. I'm really not a jack of all trades when it comes to my magic, and unlike many of my colleagues, I feel my playground is a very narrow one. So I try to speak from a place of experience in the perspective of a tradition I understand, which is Celtic stuff. So what inspired me to write about this topic is actually a very good question to ask, and the answer is layered. First of all, it was asked of me by my spirits, and that's why I thank them explicitly at the beginning of the book, because for the longest time there had been a near impossibility for me to communicate around headlessness and anything relating to that at all, because it was too personal, too intimate. It's tiptoeing very close to certain fairy pacts of mine, and speaking about any of this is always subject to negotiation in the most careful of terms, right? So, it was my will to share knowledge and experience that felt unique and worth contrasting to a broader audience in the occult. So I did negotiate the terms of this newly found freedom of speech as delicately as I could. But as I mentioned just now, it still treads very, very close to home. And then it's a little bit more difficult to admit, but I do want to rid myself of any guilt and shame I felt regarding that. I wrote these pamphlets as a way to reclaim some autonomy and agency after I had a really disempowering experience with a fairy seer that I turned to for help, navigating my compacts with headless beings. And someone I now feel took advantage of me at a point of great distress and vulnerability. You have to understand that fairy initiations and fairy mentors can be harsh. It can be isolating, it can be terrifying, it can be alienating. And as fairy workers, there is only so many people we can turn to for help when we are in trouble or when we get scared, because yes, we do get in trouble and we do get scared sometimes. So this person, was not it, and it impacted me for a long time. It's hard to identify something went wrong when someone comes really highly recommended by people you trust, people you care or admire, and so this was a bit of a sobering experience to occult politics too. So writing was also one way to heal and to do right by the spirits who walk with me and raised me in the tradition that is mine.
I think this idea that the spirits ask us to write sometimes, they ask us to create for them sometimes, it's often so that we can more fully understand them. And as you just put it then, even heal
Yes.
from things. So yeah, that's wonderful. That's really interesting. Thank you for sharing that intimate detail with us. So in your pamphlet, you describe these historical characters, these historical individuals, these Celtic headhunters. What was the drive behind this ghoulish practice, hunting out people and taking their heads?
So to the Celtic mind, headhunting and collecting and ritual beheadings were not just seen as prowesses of war. So although we could retrace a history of violence with the practice, severed heads were collected and then ceremoniously embalmed in various resins, including funeral cedar, and they were preserved, sometimes even gilded, to be kept not so much as tribute, although there was a bit of that, but as an act of respect, and if not just, devotional re reverence. We have temples and shrines who would bear the mark of displays of severed heads and skulls. And we have that text, Cormac's Glossary, which is an Irish text from around 900 BCE, which talks about the nut harvest of Maca, Maca being the war goddess that is possibly one of the triple aspects of the Morrigan. That nut harvest of Maka are the heads of men after they have been cut down. So here we have like an explicit symbolic connection that is made between, heads falling off and harvest practices, harvest season, the cutting of crops, and sheaf thrown into sacks, mounds and piles, that idea of reaping the bounty of the land. So that removal, that curation, that display of heads has been widely recounted by classical writers, and they all commented upon, the cosmological symbolism and the land symbolism around it, because it carries across matters of identity, of power, of status, and ritual gravitas. Symbolically, decapitation is also a beginning, right? It's the beginning of an initiation, the head rolling, gaining some new power.
So let's rewind a little bit, and just discuss like who were the Celts, because they weren't specifically geographically in one small location or country. Could you elaborate on that further?
Yes, of course. And that's a very good question, because who are the Celts is a difficult question to answer. So, Celtoi seems to have been the name by which the continental Celts described themselves. That's according to Greek and Roman scholars. And it's been kept as the main delineation. Translated, it's a term that is layered because it can mean something like the shouting ones, but also the hidden people, which of course, when you work with, with fairies, with the other crowd, is quite striking. So I will say that the term is attested from early Iron Age central France, and I do need to toot this horn for a second, if you will allow me, simply because, France is constantly forgotten as a nation of Celtic heritage whenever we talk about Celtic anything. That winds me up. But anyway, so we find continental Celts moving from this cradle of mainland Europe to Eastern Europe and to even the borders of Turkey and as far north as Germany. The Gauls from Gallia were found in much of Central Europe, and so particularly France, Switzerland, and Belgium, and then they spread to outer regions. But because we also find insular Celts, the Britons, the Picts, the Gaels, this does suggest that the Celts were, like all gods, at least partially immigrants, which for me, as someone who was born in France and then came to the Isles, resonates a lot, on an intimate level. So yes, you're right. It's very important we be clear that, that complex matter of most Celtic people having been mainly tribal population, no central rulership whatsoever. Scholars to this day do not necessarily agree on who or what the Celts were, and they prefer to think in terms of a certain cultural continuum because there was, an established warrior culture, for instance, there was an artistic identity, they shared similar gods, but the Celts were mostly brought together retrospectively, so although we can think of the Celts, quotation mark, as we can think of, say, the Greeks or the Romans as being one people tied to certain lands and unified with a common culture, we don't necessarily agree on who they are always. Yeah, it's complicated.
Did the Celts have a written language in any way?
Yes. And it's actually the argument that is most often brought up regarding the Celts. Because when you talk about the Celts, you always, which Celts, where, when? Because Gaelic language is not the same as Gaulish language. Brittany is not Scotland. Welsh is not Ireland. So, yeah, while our temples are long gone, our faith still remains, but we cannot think of the Celts as being one homogeneous group, but we can certainly think of them as one people. Me, I tend to narrow down my focus to Gaulish and Irish prospects.
The comparison with ancient Greece is actually pretty interesting, because the Greeks themselves had so many different cultures Thank
Thank
you.
you.
over so many different centuries, with unique cultures within an umbrella culture, an umbrella grouping. So yeah, it's very similar in some ways, I think there. You mentioned that it was the Romans that were recording these acts of specifically these acts of barbarism and brutality and and decapitations. To what degree do you think that we can trust these Roman accounts?
Okay, so it's true, it's a constant of all people that most of what we know about the Celts was mostly passed on from people of a different ethnicity, a different time, a different religion altogether. So it also does not help that the Celts as a whole did not typically commit their beliefs and practices to the written medium. Even under extreme duress, even under the threat of extinction, that's something Caesar talks about. Most of the knowledge that we have today always comes from external sources that are distant both in years or culture. For instance, Irish mythology was passed on to us by monks. Gaulish myths simply did not make it to the written medium at all. It's completely lost, all but forgotten. And that's, proof in that the fact that France then is almost never almost cited as a nation of Celtic heritage. It's really an agony, to be honest, that our voices are not found in the primary sources that we have. And those primary sources, that little lore that we have, we must treasure, of course, but we cannot allow ourselves as practitioners to be defined by it, because otherwise we're just going to worship ashes rather than kindling that very alive fire of our tradition. So that little evidence that we have, we must study, but all religion or beliefs or practices, they will require at some point a blind leap of faith, UPG, or in its highest expression, spirit-inspired or spirit-induced reflections, research, visions, and knowledge. So yes, we do have vivid accounts from scared Roman generals about the beliefs and practices of the Celts in France and around headhunting and collecting. And those accounts, they are a bit fantastical. If the people listening end up purchasing the book or pamphlet, we have one in particular from Lucan, which I quote, and it might contain some truth to it, but we must also keep in mind always that it was destined to a Roman audience who needed to be convinced of the barbaric nature of the people Rome intended to submit, to colonize and absorb. And no imperialist power, whether religious or political, has ever been peaceful. And yes, I will die on the hill that this goes for Ireland too.
In your introduction, you discuss this idea that your text is going to explore the theurgic and the thaumaturgic applications of this headless myth. Could you elaborate a little for our listeners who might not immediately understand what these terms mean?
Yes, of course. Okay, that's just me being pompous, a bit pedantic, so don't mind it. What I meant here is that there are both religious and magical practical implication to headlessness. And my pamphlet was an attempt at outlining those roles of the severed heads and headless bodies in Celtic mythologies, plural. Theurgy means the ritual practices that are associated with the invocation or evocation of the presence of one or more deities, and we touch about that. And thaumaturgy is that practical application of magic to effect change in the physical world. Hopefully that makes it a bit clearer.
Excellent, excellent. And can you tell us a little about the nature of you mentioned it very briefly earlier, and forgive me, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but the Dullahan
Doulahan, yes.
and how your work with this fascinating spiritual creature influences your magic. For instance, is this a spirit of the dead? Is it an ancestor, a fairy, or a demon?
I guess it depends who you ask. Okay, so you know the sum total of what I'm able to share at this stage about I will say my doula hun, because I will not have the pretension to believe all headless horseman spirits are the same. Certainly not. All I was able to share is in the pamphlet. I'm trying not I You know, I'm sorry, I'm really not trying to be difficult or to hide behind false advertising, but I'm also not trying to turn into a movie target for elf shots, so we're tiptoeing here. His channeled painting made it to the book cover, which is nice, there is that. But anyway, what I can prudently say is that the Dullahan is a spirit of Irish lore who, unlike the banshee, is not a harbinger of death, but a bringer of it. Okay, so where it gets a bit funny, so to speak, is that differences between gods and gods, dead ancestors, fairies, or even demons are really not an easy one in the tradition that is mine. And at the end of the day, I do think it boils down to nitpicking semantics. So I don't believe that the other crowds are entirely unrelated to the dead, or to gods. And in my experience, as well as, you know, to be frank, folkloric research and historical research, I would say that it is not a simple, clear-cut separation and definition between those categories. Okay, I need not remind you, I'm sure, that the very word for fairy in Irish comes from those burial mounds or hollow hills that they are said to dwell in, you know, the Sidhe. Whether they are all gods seeking refuge in the hollow hills, or whether they are wandering souls, the truth lies in that metonymy, the Sidhe, the hill. So that boundary between fairies and the dead is a porous one at best. And while, of course, not all fairies are human dead or human dead fairies, absolutely not, there is definitely some overlap. I would actually argue that the distinction between the other world of the dead and the ancestors and the other world of fairy is a flexible liminal one, at least in my tradition.
And I think the more that we study the catalogues of the grimoires as well, I think this same sort of liminal quality to many of the spirits that we find there is very similar. Because, especially for instance, when we look at, say, the Book of Oberon, which is very predominantly, like, very focused on the Fae, we find very Solomonic style grimoire material as well. And so we find Oberon, etc., and all of these other fairy-like creatures and spirits. But then saying, are they fairies? Are they angels? Are they demons? Are they the dead? It becomes very difficult to pin them down to any sort of unique category that everyone can agree on. There's definitely such a plurality of them that it becomes almost ridiculous, really, to even attempt to pin them down to any one definition.
It does, and you know, on the other hand, I don't mean to imply that we must fall in a sort of safe, comfortable, absolute relativism and completely refuse to seek any categorization whatsoever. Merely that, especially with fairies, in order to be able to move with them, to interact with them, and to engage with them or work with them to any degree of efficiency, we must accept their otherness and this very liminality for what it is, and move on from here. You know, we ought to be a little loose with our definitions and accept that liminality is part of the game. There is definitely a nature of fairy, a fairy nature, but I'm most simple, you see. Whatever folklore tells me a fairy is, I tend to believe and to follow.
And so could you elaborate a little further on why these spirits are connected to the burial mounds?
The Irish speak of the gods and ungods, the de agos andi. The ungods or the non-gods are, broadly speaking, all those spirits who do not directly qualify as gods. You know, those invisible we share the world with, and sometimes they are understood as attendants of the gods, you know, a maid servants or entourage, which is a point of view I personally have some reservation about. But to spell it out without metaphor, this would loosely correspond to, of course, the other crowd, the gentry, the land spirits, and other genius loci, the dead, and among them the ancestors of blood, the ancestors of craft, the ancestors of land, the mighty dead, the beloved dead, including mythical heroes, for instance. So, you know, in that broader Gallo-Irish context that is mine, gods can be fae, fae can be ancestors, and ancestors can be gods. And it really goes to show, exactly as you say, that spirits will always resist the neat taxonomy and typology that we try to assign to them. There is something in the human mind that seeks to classify, to understand, and spirits, you know, in their very mercuriality, the more we may seek to control the context, the more it proves impossible, and it always complicates matter further, but it's also making it interesting. So, is a Dullahan a fairy? Is a Dullahan a demon? Both, neither. That nature of fairy, as far as I'm concerned, and experience and believe it to be, is very mysterious indeed and volatile, but there is, yeah, overlap.
Would it maybe be easier to call them just to say, for instance, that they're just
Yes.
other
Yes.
than human?
Other than human, yeah, I like that. And I actually do use that, but you always have. If you have a probing mind, that's not entirely satisfactory either. You, with fairy, you have to hold together apparent contradictions, you know, suspend your disbelief a little bit, and still know in your heart of heart that probably all the narratives about them are true. That's the mental gymnastic.
So what is the origin then of this headless cult that, I mean, if that's what we could call it, I mean, we see in millennia past that there was a specific kind of veneration that was occurring for both human and bear skulls, which were being interacted with in potentially religious ways in caves such as Chavaux in France. We also have the myth of Perseus and his battle with the Gorgon Medusa. And in the Christian era, we have Saint John the Baptist. Do you think that there is a transmission of practice concerning the head and headlessness from like a truly ancient culture, perhaps Indo-European or even older?
Yes, so I would be just a little bit cautious about implying that there is just, you know, an uninterrupted set of practices or even just a formalized headless cult anywhere truly. But I can say that, as you pointed here, there is definitely a primordial image of the severed head or the decapitated body that has historically fascinated us. You know, I would know as a French, like, look what we did just recently for the opening ceremony of the Olympics. You know, how epic was that? That metal band playing at the Conciergerie in Paris, surrounded by decapitated Marie Antoinettes holding their own heads, singing under their arms. Like, what the fuck? That was so amazing. And referencing a revolutionary chant, no less, in a world where I think the new aristocracy billionaires may start to freak out a little bit, as they should. I've still not recovered from what I saw that day. But yeah, just bloody amazing. So I don't know if there is a headless cult, to be honest, but definitely there is. That's an image that fascinates us, headlessness and severed heads.
So returning to the Celts then, what was their understanding of the nature of the head itself in a spiritual sense?
Yes, we see it. We see the head as the seat of the soul, of the immortal soul. Our ancestors practiced the collection of human heads as it exists in relation to rites of protection, of fertilization of the crops, and of preservation and embalming of the soul. We decapitated, soulless leaders or rivals to deprive them of power and identity and gather it for ourselves. Those apotropaic uses of ritually preserved severed heads, embalmed in resin or cast in gold, or perhaps more intriguingly, those magical uses of the act of severance itself, the beheading itself as an offering to the gods, find resonance in us. In that broader context of what I've called the beheading game. That tale of Gawain and the Green Knight, for example, this is a tale that teaches us about the complex, intricate links that exist between those notions of head, face, soul, honor, breath in the Celtic mind. We have that word, enekios in Gaulish or enek in Irish, that translates both as face and honor, which is really interesting if you think of Gawain's tale, because in his story, that threat of losing face, of losing honor as a knight, is obviously amplified in the fear of losing one's own head, right? Which is really just, a fear of losing one's duty by refusing to fulfill one's fate. And fate is quite simply, to meet and submit to one's own death. So, on the spiritual level, heads was the seat of the soul. That's how we see it. And worth noting here also that the Irish word for soul, anam, also means breath. Its etymology is possibly almost connected to the word aim, which means name. And that idea that a name holds power over someone, over someone's soul by revealing something of the nature of it, is really interesting. If you connect it back to even just, the Dullahan we were talking about in Irish lore, the Dullahan was said to speak the name of his victim to draw their soul, aka their breath, out of the body. And we associated that as headhunting. See, for instance, the legend of Sleepy Hollow, for example, which is probably the most famous, tale of headless horsemen gathering heads that we still have and that everybody know about. Watch the Tim Burton movie, for example. It's an excellent, excellent representation of a Dullahan. So yeah, anyway, headless horsemen effectively claiming the head of a victim, they claim the soul because the soul is located in the head.
It's fascinating that across so many different cultures as well, that idea of the breath and then the being connected with the soul and that of the name, as you just mentioned, all those things being connected through multiple different cultures, not just what you know, personally I understand it more from a Greek perspective and that, but the way you're explaining it too, it appears to be so much more prevalent throughout Europe than I was aware of originally.
Yeah, definitely. It's I don't want to make this all about the Celts, but also this is what I know. So this is where I come from.
The Jewish tradition as well, that idea of the breath and speaking the name is very, yeah. So this is something that I wouldn't say universal, but it's definitely something that we see appearing and expressing itself through human cultures all over the world and throughout history. So it's fa very fascinating. It's also interesting, I think, historically, the soul was also was generally assumed to be the heart, and we see a shift to the head at some point in history. I'm not sure where that is delineated or what culture specifically where that idea comes from, but it's very interesting to see that shift of the seat of the soul.
Yeah, definitely. And I think when you look at different culture and sort of ask yourself where is the soul located, the bodily parts that will be the answer tells you something about that culture. I'm absolutely convinced of it. Like just this consistency in the Celtic mind with the breath, the soul, the honor, the face, the head, it's just so amazing. But you know, there is probably equally a lot of links to be made with the heart. And yeah, it's fascinating, really.
I want to move on now for me, the most fascinating aspect of your writing in this pamphlet. You talk about grains, seed sowing, harvests, timekeeping, and the stars, sacrifice, the castration of a father, and all of these motives that are familiar to a Saturnian god. So in your pamphlet, you focus a lot on this one specific god. If we could call him a god, I'm not sure, but you outline this individual named Crom, who is one of the Fomores, a titan, if we were using a Greek equivalent. That there's also something of this idea of the foreigner in him, as he travels to Ireland and the British Isles from the mainland. As well as this deeply telluric quality, which connects him to the underworld. I mean, is this something of the Indo-European Saturn or Kronos?
Yes, definitely. I think there are really compelling parallels that exist between that proto-Celtic deity Crom, sometimes called Crom Crac or Crom Du, and the Titan Saturn Kronos as Lords of the Harvest. These are gods that have a fascinating overlap in their theurgic functions, in their cult following, in the pacification and propitiation techniques, and in their respective dominions over such notions as death, time, and human sacrifice. You know, we talked about those apotropaic powers hidden for the Celtic mind in the act of decapitation as a severance that tells us something about our relationship to the other world and these beings in particular. Now, equating Saturn and, Kronos or Cronus may be a debatable stance for some, from a polytheistic perspective. And I must admit that in the pamphlets, I've sort of blended them together just for to simplify matter a little bit, which is always dodgy, so be careful. You might disagree with my conclusions. So any mistakes in interpretation, completely my own. But anyway, Saturn and Crom, they are both old gods, ancient gods, gods before the gods. And in fact, they arguably are themselves gods of the gods, because they are predating the class of spiritual beings that we generally know as the gods of, the gods of the Romans and the Greeks, the gods of the Celts. Kronos, as a titan, precedes the Olympians. And you will correct me if I'm wrong here, but Crom, as a god of the Fomorians, which is one of the first mythical races of Irish mythology, typically embodying oppressive forces, by the way, comes before the Tuatha Dé Danann, those Irish gods as they came to be known in the myths, constantly fighting the Fomorians for the greater good. Crom is very much not a well-known god. Much of what we know has been compiled about him from the various hagiographies of Saint Patrick, because Saint Patrick is said to have fought Crom over the harvest. The origins of the introduction of the cult of Crom in Ireland are really a question for much consideration, because we have some accounts arguing that the deity was brought by the Fomorians from distant lands across the sea. He's believed, to have come with a hunchback with the first supply of wheat to Ireland, a sack of grain and all the knowledge associated with it. But at the same time, there is also this belief of what happened to Kronos after he was castrated, you know, because you have Plutarch, I think, who mentions the exile of Cronos to a foreign island located within proximity to or off the coast of Britain, which is really interesting because, you know, the topic of displaced or you know, moving gods is always an interesting one. There is, you know, loaded references here. So is Cronos, is it, you know, right to sort of equate those gods? I don't know. I found, you know, as a practitioner, that there are very good things to be made of these parallels, but to fully equate does not always work. It's not always conclusive. It's not always relevant or pertinent. So I will say that Crom is definitely a Saturnian force, and that an apparent lineage here makes sense. But you know, multiple places can have similar or overlapping gods without them necessarily needing to be each other. You know, a more likely scenario could be that there was a native god which was associated in the British Isles with the harvest, and that became conflated with, you know, different population movements with Cronos or Kronos due to the similarities of their myths, you know. But yeah, remaining is that piling of sheaf and grain and that piling of headless corpses corresponding together, which is really interesting.
And you talk a lot about blood and fertility, the dead, and indeed violent death via decapitation. So these gods and the Fae, they're not pleasant. They're primordial and deeply rooted within the natural world. So perhaps that idea of Crom being this fertility god is just an expression of nature that we all intrinsically conceptualize together. So it might not be that he's specifically Kronos or Saturn, but it's just still that same sort of motif and that same sort of expression of nature which we venerate. Well, actually, venerate, that's not necessarily the best word to use, because these spirits, or this god in particular, was considered rather dangerous. And so for our audience, how would you think that ancient peoples engaged with this force in their daily lives? How would people interact with this Titan proto god?
Do you know that expression called crying the neck of the last sheaf of grain standing in the field at harvest time?
I don't know.
So, you know, a lot of the folklore around that last sheaf of grain is really interesting, the last one that you harvest in the fields during harvest season. And what you do with that sheaf of grain is always super interesting because, you know, this is where you craft dollies, for instance, with wheat or corn. This is where the spirit of the harvest is thought to reside. But just the fact that we call that crying the neck is so interesting to me. Is it like a severance, you know? Is it the last decapitation? So how do ancient people, or how do we engage with these forces in our daily lives? We do it symbolically, we do it mythically, we do it via propitiation, careful and fearful. If I can read aloud a bit of a quote, if that's okay, from Edward Gwynne, which is also found in the pamphlet, that tells us a little bit about Crom, for instance, and how we venerated in him. "It is there the king idol of Ireland was, Crom Crac, and 12 idols of stone around him, but he was of gold. He was gold to every people that took Ireland. It is to him they used to offer the firstborn of every stock and the firstborn of every family. It is to him that Ingenmas, son of Folar, king of Ireland, came at Samhain, together with men and women of Ireland, to adore him. And they all bowed before him. He was their god, the wizened-bent one with many glooms. For him, ingloriously, they slew their wretched firstborn with much weeping and distress, to pour out their blood around the bent one of the hill. Milk and corn they used to ask of him, speedily in return for a third of their whole progeny. Great was the horror and outcry about him.
Beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful and terrifying.
Yes.
So those the 12 stones about him, is that his connection to the zodiac?
Good question. Good question. We know that Crom had that golden idol, and we know that it was a gilded stone head, which already, you know, is quite a staunch example of a Celtic cult of the head. And that giant stone head stood surrounded by 12 standing stones. Indeed, yes, they have been interpreted as representing, you know, the signs of the zodiac, but also the month of the year, you know, around the solar totem. So it does suggest here a link to whatever the matter, you know, the secret movements of the stars and the passage of time. Whether, you know, we account for it in the stars or in human metrics of time, it's definitely, I think, a primitive calendar, you know, either cosmic or agricultural or both. There is definitely both stellar and solar attributes here. You know, the Celts are known for their standing stones erected to commemorate and celebrate significant astrological points in times, you know, such as, of course, Stonehenge, marking the solstices and the equinoxes. We have the exhumation of the Coligny calendar in Gaul or France, which definitely attests of their preoccupation with seasonal observances. So yeah, it's interesting for Crom. What could that mean? I don't have a definitive answer. For me, it's everything at once. Working with the gods, I found that both, you know, secret things regarding the stars and the zodiac work with him, but very much so everything regarding to seasonal calendar and agricultural rites. This is the most pregnant one, I would say, pregnant with meaning.
So sticking with that potential astrological link there, in your pamphlet you refer to Crom as the Chthonic sun or the sun in the underworld, with my back to the air of the north. Could you unpack that a little? This one line seems to be, as you just said, particularly pregnant with meaning.
I love it when people pick up on the tiniest detail, you know, and I must commend you on that one because yes, you are right, it is pregnant with meaning. In Irish folklore, the winds and the you know, the north have a very rich and multifaceted significance. We have with the north a very strong connection to the supernatural, and particularly the fairy realm and various mythological beings. You know, winds were not just seen as natural phenomenon, but as also manifestations of spiritual forces. We can think, for instance, of the Sluagshi, you know, the flying hosts of fairies and the dead, who played quite a malignant role in folklore, you know. So winds were often seen as messengers or manifestation of the Shi, and those winds could carry either good fortune or complete disaster for the human beings. And the north, you know, holds a very special place in the Irish mind too, because it's often regarded as a direction of battle, of death, of slaughter, of coldness, of hardship. You know, some sources suggest that the north was very much connected with the realm of dead and ancestors. It's definitely less associated with divine qualities, you know, but it's more earthbound and practical. Then in the medieval period, we have that association of the north with earth and with the winter solstice, which is obviously very relevant to Headless Mysteries. It's called Harsh and Wintry Condition. You know, where I'm from in the Alps, for example, it was believed that the north wind would bring the darkness and the cold of winter. And in some texts, that north wind is viewed as a wind of death, you know, the wind that brings back the ancestors and all the dead people to torment us. So yeah, standing here with my back to the air of the north is a way to hold barrage in a way with all of that, but also to stand in the middle and to be present with those associations.
So I'm particularly fascinated by this idea of the god of the dead hosting banquets in his house for the newly departed. There are a lot of spirits in the European grimoire tradition that specifically provide such a feast for the attendant spirits. Could you elaborate further on that?
I mean, I will admit my ignorance on the grimoire tradition, but I'm just like you. I'm very moved by that idea of God's ancestors welcoming his host with a banquet in the other world. Yes.
What function does this banquet serve in the myth of the Dullahan?
Okay, it's a layered one because, you know, there is this god ancestors of the Irish who host the banquet. His name is Don, which means brown or black. That comes from the word dubh, which is also the first half of the Dullahan word. Okay, Dullahan comes from dubh, black or dark, and Lahan, I think, was a more complicated word that refers to a fairy or an elf. So there is a link between this god ancestor hosting the banquet and the Dullahan, definitely, you know, chthonic black riders. Now, what link there is explicitly, I have to be honest and say there is none exactly. What I would say is that sharing food with, you know, gods or with spirits is a way to commune with them. Literally, you know, companions means sharing the bread with, and then you are from the same family, the same kin. So a god that welcomes you after you're dead, and serves you food is also a gesture of hospitality, but also to make you like them, you know it. And it's pretty much universal because you find that, you know, with the myth of Persephone, you eat the food of the spirits, then you become trapped with them because then you become like them and you can't exactly come back. So this is the link I would make.
You know, I never thought about the etymology of the word companion, and pan being the a very common European word for bread. That's incredible. So to eat together, that's fantastic.
That's it, yes.
I love it. I love it. So Briar, you mentioned just before that the spirits that you work with, if you wish to develop further a relationship with them, it necessitates a pact. Now, for my listeners that know a little about the grimoire tradition, you'll know that the Grimorium Verum also has its primary ritual, which is based on a pact. So I'm curious, is there any what are the mechanics behind this pact from your perspective? I'm really curious to learn about that because there's clearly some kind of a communication from ancient folklore, which is finding its way into the grimoires in this way. So, could you elaborate on that idea of the pact?
Yes. Well, I say yes. I can try. It's difficult because I cannot go into the specifics of mine, for instance, or of what I've observed for clients I've helped with the other crowd. But what I can say is that it is not as formal as, say, what you would find in a grimoire, where you evoke the spirits and aspect the spirits maybe to an extent and take a pledge and be careful of your words. With the gentry, it's much more numinous, I would say, and at the same time, it is just as strong. Whenever I speak of them, I feel them behind my shoulders, carefully watching what it is I share and pressing into my skin, like, shut the fuck up right now, or, you know, that feeling of dread, like I'm starting to say too much. So even now, during this question, I feel in my tone of voice a wariness.
So, for instance, do you said it's more numinous. Do you mean that, for instance, of course it's not as what's the best way of putting it? Maybe it's not as structured as rigidly as a grimoiric pact. But for instance, perhaps some of the mythic language is the same. So are we talking about you're making a call in a specific place at a specific time with certain magica materia present?
No, I mean, you can, but I want to be very careful in what I say because, in my experience, I would not recommend people seek them out if they are not called by the gentry first. Now, what this invitation looks like can vary immensely, and as a practitioner who get your hand dirty, you know, go into the forest, collect some materia or plant some. Eventually, as a practitioner, you will find your way. You will bump into a fairy or two. But you can stay a good neighbor, you know, and have like working relationship that are just like with a neighbor, really, you know, distant but cordial. And that's what I generally recommend people keep to if they want to develop a relationship that is peaceful with the other crowd, to keep to seasonal rite of propitiation and see if something develops from here. Now, I don't also want to give the impression that they are absolutely terrifying and that, you know, gatekeeping kind of thing. I just want people to be aware that there is a real danger in being involved with the other crowd, as we know. But there is also a lot of joy, a lot of beauty, a lot of love that can be found. So I would not recommend, yes, that people try and make a pact with a fairy being this way, you know, with offering and they're, hey, just take me, you know, I'm interested in working with you. Please don't do that. At the same time, if you have been marked, you will know it because it will express itself in your life in all kinds of different ways. Sometimes it's expressing itself with dreams, sometimes with near-death experience, sometimes with wasting illnesses, sometimes with very much harassment, you know, that constantly nagging at you until you pay the fuck attention to what is happening. But yeah, it's a delicate thing, fairy pacts.
So I always love a bit of astrological speculation on this podcast because I'm very fond of attempting to look at the past to find information and learn from ancient concepts of astrology and apply them to a modern context and try and learn about, try and rediscover things that, from the past that to help us really understand the context of what I'm experimenting with when I'm doing magic, particularly. But you mention Orion as a headless hunter, and that the Orion, the constellation, acquires a head in some situations, namely when the sun or the moon move into its proximity. So, could you discuss something more about that that idea of the headless hunter gaining the sun or the moon as a head?
Yes, of course. As long as we've had an understanding of the stars and their secret movements and the traveling of the planets, we have made myths and stories about them. So I couldn't exactly tell you how far back that myth goes back. If I had to take a guess regarding Orion, we would have to look at, Egyptian myths surrounding Osiris. We would have to look at what the Greek thought about Orion and the scorpion. To me personally, and it's very much UPG, I think I see Crom in, well, I don't think I see Crom in Orion. I see in Orion those mysteries of the sacrifice of the self, and of headlessness tied to, ascetic self-seclusion, watching the sun die as it sets. In the winter solstice, I bathe one last time in its bloody rays in remembrance of the sacredness of that severance. You need the losing of one's own head in ecstasy. It's a sort of ego death, in astrology, the sun being the self. There is a lot of keys to magical knowledge here, and it makes a lot of symbolic sense, with beheading as being a literal tool to leave the body and the self behind. So that's what I see personally. And Orion, we know, comes back into the sky around that period of the year. It comes back in the sky during the winter. So yeah, it's all very linked.
Oh, it's fascinating to me. I adore researching this subject, and especially getting the opinions of people whose practice is way outside of my own. So talking to you really helps me sort of contextualize a lot of things and put some parts of the jigsaw puzzle together. And yeah, this is one of the reasons that I absolutely love doing this. It's really good fun.
I'm like you. I love contrasting, your perspective with the one of another, and especially when someone is knowledgeable, you gain so much insight. And even Orion, it's so interesting because in the northern hemisphere, obviously, Orion appears standing upright, but in the southern hemisphere, Orion is inverted. Okay, it's suspended, in fact, upside down, which is strangely echoing, that enigma of the way we have Irish bog bodies, that were deposited sometimes upside down with, preserved headless corpses found upright or downright in stagnating water. So there is just so much here, in that headless shape of Orion in the star. That's really a section of the star, Orion, the Pleiades, that just really speaks to me a lot.
To wrap up in a way, and to sort of to bring our conversation full circle, and sort of including everything that we've talked about, let me ask a question then that you yourself ask in the pamphlet, which is, what happens to an old god who found sustenance in sacrifice once his devotees have disappeared?
I love these questions because obviously we don't go about any more headhunting, The heads were seen as a produce to be reaped, and this had deeper implication. We can recreate some of that with just harvest rites, for instance. That beheading game or that joust of headlessness, it is a trope, it is a pattern that has endured in a number of ways. With the appearance of Christianity, syncretic practices emerged, and all gods were slowly not forgotten, but certainly replaced to an extent by the new. And it's an interesting case, though it's much argued that the Irish and to an extent some European tribes proclaim that the pagan gods never really left the lands. Folk beliefs report that they simply adapted, you know, for instance, in Ireland, retreating under the heels of the mounds, the Sidhe, where they slowly became known as the Sidhe themselves, the fairy people. So those gods, they adapt. Arguably, Crom adapted in the figure of the Dullahan. How that is still evidenced in the fear that is always the same one, losing face, losing honor, losing your soul. And yeah, you know, that king I was telling you about, King Tingamas, who was one of the devotee of Crom, was himself reportedly struck dead with his army in the middle of the celebration to Crom on Samhain's Eve, which in a way resulted in that ultimate sacrifice to a god that was known to be appeased only by blood. And I don't know if you've ever hand pulled the grain from a wheat chaff, but you will find that the grain still has an appetite for blood.
Right. That's incredible. So thank you so much for sharing all this truly incredible information with us. But honestly, I think that there's still just so much more that we could talk about. I mean, this is one of Hadean Press's more information dense pamphlets. I couldn't recommend it enough for people who are interested in buying it and reading it from no matter what tradition you're working under, because it you get this extra you get this window into a region of magical practice that I think is almost, you know, it's not very popular, it's not explored as much as I think it should be. So I'm really keen to learn more myself, actually. And I think there's so much more that we could collectively learn by expanding our purview, looking further into Europe, especially into specifically into the mythology of the Celts and that. And there's just, you know, even archaeological evidence and that. There's so much more information out there that we can start to piece together something more of this European tradition. It's not one tradition, it's so many traditions all interlinked over centuries, but it all ultimately, I think, it all creates this tapestry of paganism that is just so worth our time to explore and to look into. So thank you so much for writing this and for
Thank
taking
you.
the time to discuss it with me, because it's just something I find infinitely fascinating. But Briar, do you have any books that you would like to recommend to our audience?
Yes, sure. Well, I'm a bit overwhelmed by your generosity of compliments here. So thank you so much, and thank you for having me. I can be cheeky and promote the extensive bibliography in the pamphlet, but no, in truth, I guess it depends what you're most interested in. If you're, you know, if you're interested in headlessness or decapitated bodies and severed heads from a philosophical perspective, I would recommend The Severed Head from Julia Kristeva. If you want something perhaps a bit more accessible and directly contemporary and very much political as well, into how headlessness continues to be a pervasive motif for us as human beings, I would recommend El Hombre Sin Cabeza. I believe it is translated in English, but off the top of my head, I don't, I mean, probably The Man Without a Head or something like that by Jorge Sergio González Rodríguez. If you are interested in purely, you know, that fantastic archaeological study around headlessness, then Headhunting and the Body in Iron Age by Ian Armitt is a very good one. If you are interested in the Dullahan and how funny, actually, Dullahan can be, and I know it's strange to say that, but they can. I really recommend Fairy Legends and Traditions of the South of Ireland, which is excellent for Dullahan lore, by Thomas Crofter Corton. And if you are interested, you know, as in the skull as an object of art and cult, then Le crâne, objet de culte, objet d'art by Gaston is an excellent one. And finally, of course, I cannot, you know, praise enough Marianne McNeill, The Festival of Lunasa, a study of survival of a Celtic festival of the beginning of the harvest, which is literally a Bible. It's incredible.
Thank you for sharing all of those. All of those books will be listed in the description at the bottom of the video. And so, Briar, is there anything else that you're working on at the moment, or anything that you're particularly obsessed with that you would like to share with the audience before we say goodbye?
Yeah, I'm always obsessively working on different things, but you know, I'm a bit superstitious, so I don't tend to talk about projects until they are completely finished. People who are interested to see more of my work or to read me further can find me on my website, The Green Chapel. I write a lot here about what moves me, and I also, you know, offer classes and courses and some manner of occult wares. And I do have an Instagram page as well with the same handle, Green Chapel, if you want to come and say hi in a less formal setting.
All right, well, excellent. Briar, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It is I who thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Briar, author of The Beheading Game, Unearthing the Occult Mysteries of the Celtic Cult of the Head, available now from Hadean Press. Briar's pamphlet is one of the more information-dense guides to the underworld that we have produced, and I honestly feel that it punches far beyond its weight with the ideas contained within its pages. I was really impressed by how grounded and even skeptical Briar is of her knowledge and tradition, as well as her rejection of elitism, which is strongly evident in the way in which she discusses her experiences and how she writes in her pamphlet. Briar describes writing as an act of healing and processing disillusionment, expressing an intimacy and vulnerability in this art, which I think is quite rare, and I think really telling of her strength and the power of her work. It's evident from our conversation that Briar deeply respects her relationship with her spirits. There were so many parts of our conversation that I really loved, and I learned a great deal from Briar's descriptions of Crom as the sun in the underworld, as an immigrant god. And I love Briar's understanding of stellar lore, especially those ideas connected to the North Wind, Orion, and headlessness. She's actually really helped me understand a great deal of my own personal work, and deeply, deeply grateful for that. One of my favorite quotes from Briar in this interview was, "We must treasure our primary sources, of course, but we cannot allow ourselves as practitioners to be defined by it, because otherwise, we're just going to wash in ashes rather than kindling that very alive fire of our tradition." Wise words I think we should pay close attention to. I hope to get another chance to interview Briar again in the future. Thank you all for listening this far. As I mentioned at the beginning of our podcast, Underworld with Hadean Press is now available on Spotify and Apple Podcast, etc. I will be updating that as and when I get the chance. Please check out Briar's guide through the link below, as well as her website, The Green Chapel. And please like and subscribe to our podcast. It really helps. And tune in again next month for our interview with two of my absolute favorite people, Brian Johnson and Al Cummings, as we discuss their latest grimoiric offering, The Black Raven. Until then, I have been your host, Matt Hadfield, and I will see you all again in the next one.